I have a question for us today. Have you ever wondered what it was like, what it would be like to win the lottery? Can you imagine the end of financial troubles, of living day to day on the wages we receive or the retirement benefits we may receive? We could go on trips. We can help family. We could help friends. We could buy a nice home in a nice neighborhood. My preference would be on the beach of Malibu. We could live life. It'd be so much easier if we had all the money that a lottery could give us. The stresses of the grind would be over. And we can give more money to the church. So guess what? Everybody will benefit if we could win the lottery. But especially us. I would like to read an article from CNBC Online entitled, "Here's Why Lottery Winners Go Broke, August 25th, 2017, by Abigail Hess. After winning the biggest undivided jackpot lottery in U.S. history, Mavis Wencheck of Chicopee, Massachusetts, ignored much of the advice the financial experts give to lottery winners. She quit her job, spoke to the press, and took her winnings as a lump sum. While she may be able to afford to break the rules, most winners can't. Lottery winners are more likely to declare bankruptcy within 3 to 5 years than the average American. What's more, studies have shown that winning the lottery does not necessarily make you happier or healthier." The article goes on. "Evidence shows that most people who make it to the top 1% of income earners usually don't stay at the top very long," writes the Washington Post Jonette Marte. Economist Jay Sigorski agrees with the research. He writes for U.S. News and World Report. "Studies found that instead of getting people out of financial trouble, winning the lottery got people into more trouble, since bankruptcy rates soared for lottery winners 3 to 5 years after winning. Jack Whitaker, who won $315 million in a lottery in West Virginia in 2002, tells Time, "I wish I had torn the ticket up." Since winning, Whitaker's daughter and granddaughter died due to drug overdoses. Just 8 months after winning, he was robbed of $545,000. "I just don't like Jack Whitaker. I don't like the hard heart I got," he said. "I don't like what I have become. He's the last person I would have prototyped for going completely crazy, but he did." Don McNay, a financial consultant to lottery winners and the author of Life Lessons from the Lottery, tells Time about Whitaker. "No question, it was because he won the lottery." McNay says many winners struggle with suicide, depression, and divorce. "It's the curse of the lottery because it made their lives worse instead of improving them," he says. Another major struggle that winners often face is saying no to friends and family who hope to join in the good fortune. Charles Conrad, senior financial planner at Zarka Financial, told Teresa Dixon Murray, "Once family and friends learn of the windfall, they have expectations of what they are entitled to," he explained, "and it's very difficult to say no." Of course, some lottery winners survive the tumult and go on to thrive. Missouri lottery winner Sandra Hayes has managed to keep her head above water even after splitting the $224 million Powerball jackpot with 12 co-workers. "I had to endure the greed and the need people have trying to get you to release your money to them. That caused a lot of emotional pain," she told the Associated Press. "These are people you've loved deep down, and they're turning into vampires trying to suck the life out of me." The article concludes, "The former social worker has avoided financial misfortune by maintaining her frugal lifestyle, even though she no longer lives paycheck to paycheck. I know a lot of people won the lottery and are broke today," she said. "If you're not disciplined, you will go broke. I don't care how much money you have." The article I just read shows that just having financial success, winning the lottery, is not a guarantee of financial stability. Financial success does not equate to financial stability as seen in the article. There are other examples. We hear of professional athletes, Hollywood stars, those who are considered living in the 1%. They've had financial success in their lives, but they are not financially stable. The money is there at one point, then gone, and many times with nothing to show for it. So what is the definition of financial stability? What am I talking about? According to the International Monetary Fund, financial stability is defined in terms of the ability to facilitate and enhance economic processes, manage risks, and absorb shocks. In our personal lives, it would equate to having our finances managed to such a state that we can handle our situations in good times and in challenging times, and we can fulfill and meet ours and our family's basic needs. It's not only preparing for lean times, but it's managing our finances when times are good, when we do have adequate resources, and we're not foolish with what we have. Today, I would like to discuss a key to financial stability in our lives. In fact, the title of this message is The Key to Financial Stability in Our Lives. This is not a prosperity message. You can find those on the internet. What I'm going to do is look at scriptures where God tells us what to do, how we get financially stable. It's not a prosperity message that we would go to scriptures where God will bless us physically if we do A, B, C, X, Y, or Z. It's a message about the key factor to financial stability in our lives. By embracing it, we could prosper. We could. However, it's more a message about achieving financial stability and the peace of mind it brings. In thinking about this key, it may be we have tried and we struggled to get our financial house in order, and yet we can't seem to do it. Our lives have not improved, and we regress into more debt and more financial problems. If we were to look at our financial situation in the last year, do we find ourselves further in debt? Are we experiencing greater marital problems as a result of our inability to manage finances? Are we more anxious about our financial situation than we were a year ago? Our lives are more hurried, more complex than before. Are we less appreciative of what we have? If we are in this situation, it may be due to not embracing this one factor that we will talk about today. Embracing this one factor is the absolute key in achieving financial stability in our lives. So what is this factor? What is the key to financial stability? To examine this, let's look at Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10. It states in Ecclesiastes 5, verse 10, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is also vanity." The New Living Translation renders this verse as follows: "Those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless is to think that wealth brings true happiness." The article which we read earlier at the beginning of this message showed that additional wealth, a huge infusion of funds, does not necessarily mean that one will be happy. That doesn't necessarily mean that all of a sudden when a windfall of money comes, that a person gains responsibility with the newfound wealth. Newfound wealth does not necessarily result in happiness and does not necessarily result in financial stability. So if additional funds don't result in financial stability, what does? I propose to you today that the key to financial stability revolves around our emotions. Our emotional outlook, our emotional health has a strong impact on the way we will be handling our finances, our financial stability. In an article entitled The Emotion of Money, Kristen Merriam Clark recounts an interview with Susie Orman regards to emotions and money. The article starts, "People really do not have a clue at all," she says with deep conviction. "They think the reason they are miserable, that they are an emotional wreck, is because they absolutely have no money. They honestly think that if they had money, or more money, they would have fewer problems. The problem is that it's not true. The reason they don't have more money is because how they feel about their life and who they are. Who you are determines what you have and get to keep. You define your money. You define the things around you. But money and the things around you can never truthfully define who you are." Although the word emotion does not appear in the Bible, many specific examples of emotion are included in the Bible. The word anger is mentioned 270 times. The word joy, 242 times. Other emotions are also mentioned. For example, grief is mentioned 35 times. Mourning is mentioned 47 times. Mourn is mentioned 138 times. Sadness is only mentioned once, and frightened is only mentioned 9 times. The Bible discusses multiple emotions as part of the human experience. And with regard to emotion, the Bible encourages us to put more energy into positive emotions than the negative. Turn to Colossians 3, verse 8. Colossians 3, verse 8. Colossians 3, verse 8. And today I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. I find that version a little clearer in the scriptures I'm going to present. So if you have the New King James, you can follow along. Colossians 3, verse 8. "But now you must put away them all away, anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth." As you've seen in this scripture, the Bible encourages us to rid ourselves of anger and other negative emotions. Instead, the Bible encourages us to focus in another direction. Turn to Philippians 4, verse 8. Philippians 4, verse 8. Philippians 4, verse 8. "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." Emotions are fleeting. However, we can choose how we direct our energy. We have the freedom to think about positive things, things that are good. We have the freedom, the choice to focus on positive emotions. We can also have the freedom, and we do have the freedom, to focus on the negative. In a New York Times article entitled How to Treat a Money Disorder, author Sarah Kershaw noted the following about the impact of emotions. "Among the problem financial behaviors identified by psychologists in recent years are overspending, underspending, aka the depression, otherwise known as depression mentality, serial borrowing, financial infidelity, cheating on a spouse by spending and lying about it, workaholism, financial enabling, throwing large sums at, let's say, adult children who are not motivated to support themselves, hoarding, and plenty of guilt and shame around poverty and wealth." Emotions are inexorably linked with financial decisions, with making progress. In fact, are necessary to make the correct choices in many situations. Even a small effort to put unhealthy emotions aside in certain circumstances can help us go a long way towards improving the quality of those decisions. When dealing with money and emotion, we have to ask ourselves, is money the center of our life? Now, on the surface, we would say, oh, of course not. God is the center of our life. And I hope that's true. But when our financial situation is taking such a toll on us, on our emotion, on our energy, we're losing sleep, when it becomes the center of what we do, could it be taking more of our emotions, more of our thought, more of our time than our relationship with God? Julie Murphy Casserly is a veteran of financial services industry, makes the following assessment of emotions and money. Facing your financial reality means taking an honest look at where your finances line up with the rest of your life. So what's at the center of your life? When I pose this question to my clients, they almost always say one of four things: work, family, personal endeavors, or finances. Of these four reasons, finances is usually the one answer I hear. When people realize that center of their life is money, they feel shame, guilt, even sadness. The domino effect of this choice is incredible. They work a job they don't like because it's safe and gives a good salary. And even worse, they fear losing that same job because of the money. A large percentage of their current cash flow goes to pay off past debt. Or they can't realize their true dreams because they are chained to a standard of living to keep up appearances with their peers. Does that sound familiar? I will ask you again, what is the center of our lives? Just take a few moments here and complete the sentence. If I had more money, I would fill in the blank. Some of us may have thought, well, retire, relax, travel. So others might have thought, well, I'll get rid of some of that debt that's burdening our family. Others may say, I can start a business, and I'll show my boss how it could be done, how people should be treated, how to motivate people in the field. Someone might have said, if I had more money, I could build my dream home. Or some may say, I could go back to school. Others might say, I would spend a large amount of time with my family. Even though the responses you can see are varied, they all share one thing in common: emotions. Some strong, some deep. People imagine that money will provide personal fulfillment for themselves and for their loved ones, that it will give them a sense of security and exciting new possibilities for their life ahead. You notice in my question, I didn't give a dollar amount. I just said more money. Sometimes we get too busy dreaming about the answered prayers and defeated fears that multiple zeros added to the right side of our savings account balance could instantly create. Almost everyone has something to add to. If I won the lottery, I would. Our personal finances is a rational and logical process on the outside. It's about budgeting, right? And saving, of income and cash flows, of insuring against ruin and investing for the future. But on the inside, it is completely emotional. Our decisions are influenced by our attitudes about money, what we learned growing up, and the experiences we've had along the way that either made us more cautious or more confident. What money means to each one of us individually is just under the surface. It shapes our daily spending, our tolerance for risk, or if we can even stand to think about money matters at all. It reflects our emotions attached to money, good or bad. Then we equate having enough with being respected, happy, and sometimes even people equate having money with love. Our emotions can have a great impact on spending and financial decisions. If we feel something is missing from our lives, or that we don't measure up to the expectation of others, or we don't measure up to the expectations that we put upon ourselves, we might buy something to prove to ourselves that we are okay. We buy something to fill the void. Or we might pass up opportunities that could be putting us ahead financially in the long term, like saving for retirement or building an emergency fund to spend it now to fill a need, a perceived need in our lives because of our emotions. Our emotions can change from day to day, but when it comes to our financial situation, we need to ask ourselves, is the financial debt we have incurred, the credit card, the loans, a result of not keeping our emotions in check? Let's be real. The fix, the enjoyment, the excitement you get from a purchase is only temporary. The new car we bought a while ago does not have the luster it once had. Now it's an item for which we make monthly payments, and for some, for many years. Question, do we, even unconsciously, try to appease our emotions through money? So before we can discuss the key to financial stability, I want to explore three sets of emotions that can impact our financial state. The first set of emotions I would like to discuss is fear or anxiety. In a New York Times article entitled How to Treat a Money Disorder that I quoted earlier, Sarah Kershaw noted the following story. Amy Sprague Champeau was destitute following a divorce and with no college education or job opportunities, wound up living in her car. When she finally rented a room, her only furniture was a piece of foam for a bed. Soon after she began earning some money, she ran up a large credit card and debts and became choked by fear. As I mentioned earlier, the use of money usually comes weighted down with some form of emotion. Have we ever indulged our spouse, a family member, ourselves with an extravagant gift? Didn't that feel good? On the other side of the emotional spectrum, have we ever worried about paying a utility bill? Have we ever lost sleep because of the financial situation we found ourselves in? Even when we think we're long-term thinkers by paying for a home, saving for retirement, or saving for a child's college education, fears and dreams shape our behavior. Our emotional connection to money has some general subtext as well. We might think things like, I'm afraid my son or daughter won't get a good job. I'm afraid I'll end up a dependent and on the kindness of others for my daily needs. I know if I just give this investment strategy one more shot, it'll work. I will succeed. We might think things like, I'm comfortable, but I'm scared to wish or ask for more. I feel guilty for having so much when others don't. Or we might think things like, I know nothing about managing money, and whenever I try, I feel like a failure. There's a lot of fear that surrounds finances. Fear of dependency, fear of success, fear of failure, fear of loss, fear of the unknown. With our children, we're afraid they won't succeed, will not find happiness. Our fears not only impact our financial situation, but our lives as a whole. So we need to transform our fears into more constructive emotions, and it will improve our financial situation. It will not only do that, it will improve our life situation. But how does one live a fearless life? If we want to create a financial future that's different from our current situation, it'll be necessary for us to give up certain behaviors and take that necessary step into the unknown, into the untried. Consider these words by Ruben Gonzalez, three-time Olympic luge athlete and world champion. Every time you do something you fear, you gain strength, confidence, courage, and faith. You must always stop and look fear in the face and do what you think you cannot do. The good news, we don't have to hurl ourselves down an icy track to face our fears. There's less physically damaging techniques to conquer our fears. However, we need to identify what those fears are and take steps to overcome it. What are we afraid of? What causes us fear? Thinking about fear in a constructive way demystifies it. When you put your fear into words, I'm afraid I might fail. I'm afraid I won't understand. Or I'm afraid because I don't know what to expect, gives us something we can then tackle. It's no longer the unknown. We have taken the first step by addressing the fear, by verbalizing our fear. And when we identify them, then we need to redirect our thinking into a positive, constructive action. If we fear that we're not having enough to make our debt payments, establish a budget and commit to live by it, and then get rid of the credit cards for a while. If we fear that we are not being able to afford our child's educational requirements, save something, anything, each pay period, to begin researching scholarships and educational alternatives. If we fear not having enough to retire because we started late, get started now. The past is the past. Move forward. If we fear about losing our job and not having enough for daily expenses, cut our expenses now. Live on less. Learn to make extra money and develop a backup plan for our job. When we identify our fears, we'll be on our way to redefining our relationship with money. Because to be honest, self-awareness is half the battle. When we know who we are, our thoughts, our experiences, and our emotions, we can then acknowledge those fears and take action to overcome them. We can identify our weaknesses and then set goals based on our strengths. Mastering our money means facing our fears, overcoming them, and then taking concrete steps to redefine how we look at not only money, but really life in general. What is important to us? And we can take comfort that God is there for us as well. We have to do our part. We can't just sit back and not address our fears. We can't sit back and not take steps, but we have a partner in this. And we don't need to engage in fear or anxiety or worry, as the following scriptures show. Turn to Matthew 6, verse 25. Matthew 6, verse 25. Matthew 6, verse 25. Matthew 6, verse 25, it states, "Therefore I tell you, don't be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet our heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life?" 1 Peter 5, verse 6. 1 Peter 5, verse 6. 1 Peter 5, verse 6. It states, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties," not some, not the ones we want to hold on to, "all your anxieties on him, because he cares for you." A second set of emotions that can influence our financial stability is jealousy and envy. Jealousy and envy. Many of our interpersonal anxieties and social problems around a dysfunctional belief that money is somehow a measurement of fairness, equality, and human value. We can become jealous because we feel the rewards that others get are the rewards we didn't get. We deserve them. That there is competition in getting a job promotion, being employee of the year, grabbing a gold medal. But there is economic research shown that our sense of well-being is determined more by our relative wealth than by our absolute wealth. In other words, it's an unfortunate aspect of human life. We care less about how much money we have than we do about how much money we have in relation to others. Cornell economist Robert Frank conducted a survey that found that a majority of Americans would prefer to earn $100,000 while everyone else earned $85,000, rather than earning $110,000 while everyone else earned $200,000. Think about this. A person would rather earn $10,000 less if it would cause the other person to make less than they did. Does that make any sense? It shows the power of jealousy and envy in one's perspective. And indeed, jealousy and envy are powerful emotions. If someone else's wealth prevents us from being happy, then we don't control our own well-being. Effectively, they do. Whether we know it or not, whether they know it or not, if we do feel this way and we don't change our thinking, we are destined for an unhappy life. Exodus 20, verse 17. Exodus 20, verse 17. Exodus 20, verse 17. And we're familiar with this scripture in Exodus 20, verse 17. It states, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's." The root meaning for covet is a strong desire for wealth. Or a more concise terminology, greed. Covetousness is more known by a common term we hear, materialism. Paul often refers to covetousness or greed as being idolatry. Colossians 3, verse 5. Colossians 3, verse 5, where he gives us this commandment. Colossians 3, verse 5. Colossians 3, verse 5. "Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry." Idolatry is letting something or someone become our focus instead of our relationship with God. Let's try that again. When we covet things, when we go into debt for things we cannot afford, when we spend our money that we really don't have and go into debt on wants and neglect our needs, if we value the here and now, we're putting them in place of God. We are committing the sin of idolatry. Covetousness, which is a result of jealousy and envy, is an inner motivation, an attitude of the heart. It's important that for us to stop evaluating ourselves on how much money we have in relative to our family members, our neighbors, our friends, or even members of God's family. Rather, we evaluate what funds are needed for our needs to reach our goals. In life, some will have more than others. Some will have less than others. We need to accept that fact of life and focus away the feeling of what we see in our society today. 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. And I'd like to read from the New Living Translation for this set of scriptures, if I may. 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. Yet true godliness with contentment is itself great wealth. After all, we brought nothing with us when we came to the world, and we can take anything with us when we leave it. So if we have enough food and clothing, let us be content. But people who long to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and some people, craving money, have wandered from the true faith and pierced themselves with many sorrows. Turn to Mark 4, verse 18. Mark 4, verse 18, we're familiar with these sets of scriptures, the parable of the sower, but I'd like to point out verse 18 through 19. Mark 4, verse 18. Mark 4, verse 18. States, still others, like seed sown among thorns, hear the word, but the worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth and the desires for other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. A third set of emotions that can impact our financial stability is guilt or remorse. Guilt or remorse. Guilt is defined as a feeling of responsibility or remorse for some offense, failure, mistake, crime or wrong, whether real or imagined. It's associated with negative feelings such as shame, remorse, anguish, torment, self-condemnation, self-unforgiveness, self-judgment, and in extreme cases, severe depression. Guilt can result in us going into denial. Rather than deal with a tough financial situation, we would just rather ignore it. We're ashamed of ourselves getting into that situation, and it's just easier just to put it aside. We know it won't go away, but the guilt and the pain of dealing with the situation is overwhelming. And it takes, and by doing that, we take a break from the pain of guilt in our lives. Genuine guilt can be healthy to a certain level. Genuine guilt is the emotional response for our conscience that helps us to stay on course and stay away from behavior that's inconsistent with our beliefs and values. When we attempt to say something contrary to our conscience, our guilt wells up and condemns us and insists that we try to do the right thing. However, the guilt I'm speaking of here is the unhealthy kind. The unhealthy guilt cripples those when they reflect over a matter and they go over it and over it again and self-punish themselves and they hold themselves responsible for negative past events. When people live these unhealthy guilt experiences, they feel depressed, lock themselves into the past, and stay there with their failure or their transgression. And sometimes the guilt is so strong that people unconsciously block success, sabotage relationships because they feel this is their just punishment. Attitudes that contribute to guilt, fear, and anxiety about money can cause us to simply just want to escape. Unfortunately, money and denial typically go hand in hand. Denial is refusing to acknowledge or recognize a situation. The refusal to look at a situation creates serious financial issues. For example, when the bank statement comes in the mail or via electronically through email, do we just set it aside? Oh, we'll just look at it later. Do we get draft overdraft notices and because we don't know how much money is in our checking account? Or the last time we deposited money into our savings account when grandma sent us money for our birthday. And some of us, that was a long time ago. These are all symptoms of money denial. The most telling trait of a money denier is their financial story is always told in the present tense. The future is non-existent. This individual may be working and making a good living, but they've never been able to create a lifetime financial plan, to establish a budget, to set priorities. This individual uses money myopia to neutralize any fears brought about whether he or she is forced to think about his or her future. The denier will take out an occasional rash action out of necessity, but it's unlikely that the transaction will be seen through, and in their blindness, they will not have considered all the financial consequences. When things go wrong, as they do, they get angry and feel cheated. If this person is part of a couple, silence reigns when it comes to discussing money issues with a spouse. In fact, silence reigns in virtually every area that touches money. For example, the money denier will complain about how much they earn, yet never enter into discussion to require to ask for a raise. In the job interview process, when it comes time to negotiate their salary, he or she is mute. In short, this individual will accept what's ever offered and simply not accept the position. How about us? Do we escape when we get our bills? Do we ignore our spouse when it's time to talk about finances? Is the thought of dealing with our finances so overwhelming that we feel so guilty about the situation we find ourselves in, we'd rather tune out and just not deal with the situation? It is better in our minds to escape reality than to deal with reality. Romans 12, verse 2. Romans 12, verse 2. Romans 12, verse 2. Romans 12, verse 2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what the will of God, what is the good and acceptable and perfect. The New Living Translation renders this verse as follows. Don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think. Then you will learn to know God's will for you, what is good and pleasing and perfect. We are not to go into denial, to practice the behavior of this world. Debt, personal debt, is out of control, whether from even a national level. We need to change how we think. We need to accept times when we made mistakes and we learn from them. We are to change. There are times when we just have to say no. And that's so hard to do, isn't it? It's time to transform crippling guilt into action. We have seen that emotions, negative emotions, can impact our ability to be financially stable. We have seen such emotions such as fear and anxiety, jealousy, and envy. Guilt and remorse can impact our financial situation. In reviewing these emotions, it's important to deal with them, to face them head on if we want to have financial stability. So let's get back to my title. What is the key to financial stability? It's not more money. That does not make one stable. But it does revolve around our emotions, since our emotions can impact our ability to be financially stable. So what is the key? The key is simply emotional maturity. Emotional maturity. Emotional maturity is recognized that emotions, both positive and negative, can impact our lives, and especially the way we manage our finances. If it's looking at our emotions head on, evaluating them in our financial decision-making process. YourDictionary.com defines emotional maturity as how well we are able to respond to situations, control our emotions, and behave in adult manner when dealing with others. Emotional maturity isn't something that necessarily grows with chronological age. We don't get more emotionally mature when we get older. Some adults, and maybe we know some adults, they are very emotionally mature even though they have many years behind them. Some never mature emotionally. Some never are able to control their emotions. But the key to financial stability is the ability to control our emotions. It's to take a hard assessment of our emotions when we're examining situations. There's an adage I believe that's important whenever making a decision, whether it's financial or not. Never make a major decision when we are emotional. Never make a major decision, financial or otherwise, when we are emotional. When our emotions are clouding our judgment. Emotions such as fear, anxiety, jealousy, envy, guilt, remorse can cloud our judgment, can result in us making a wrong decision. Galatians 5:23, when talking about the fruits of the Spirit, mentions temperance. Merriam-Webster defines temperance as moderation in action, thought, feeling, restraint, the ability to say no. Habitual moderation in the indulgence of appetites or passions. Temperance is another word for emotional maturity. If we want to change our financial situation, we need to be willing to look at all the ways we sabotage our financial stability, the way our emotions impact our finance. We need to be willing to look at these issues, and when we do, it will become liberating. Because in the moment of saying, yes, I am willing to look at this and figure this out, we can become more energized and motivated to take on that task. The key to staying motivated is that we need to be patient. We need to be willing to take little steps, even if they're tiny, to make a difference, and as hard as they may be, to reach our goal. Proverbs 28, verse 20. And I like to read from the New Living Translation. The trustworthy person will get a rich reward, but a person who wants quick riches will get into trouble. We live in a society that wants immediate gratification. You see it on the airwaves all the time. It's the basis of marketing, instant gratification. The problem is, in many situations we find ourselves, it takes patience, effort, time to reach our goal. And if we find ourselves in financial challenges, it'll take time, patience, and effort to dig out of the hole. And as we change our ways, we can falter, we can become angry, frustrated, jealous, envious, fearful, guilt, and guilt-ridden, which will just reverse everything we've been working to change and will cause us to go down the spiral. If we choose to ignore our problems or numb them or numb our emotions, we're in trouble. And we numb our emotions through a variety of means: shopping, the internet, drinking. I would like to read a section from a presentation, a TED Talk. I sort of like that name, TED Talk, by Dr. Brené Brown. Now, Dr. Brown is a research professor at the University of Houston Graduate College of Social Work, and she has spent time studying vulnerability, courage, authenticity, and shame. As an introduction, the topic she was speaking about that I'm going to read from the transcript was vulnerability. That is, by definition, capable of being physically or emotionally wounded. And I'd like to read from it. Why do we struggle with it so much? Am I alone in struggling with vulnerability? No. So this is what I learned. We numb vulnerability when we're waiting for the call. It was funny. I sent something out on Twitter, on Facebook, that says, how would you define vulnerability? What makes you feel vulnerable? And within an hour and a half, I had 150 responses because I wanted to know what was out there. Being turned down, asking someone out, waiting for the doctor to call back, getting laid off, laying off people. This is the world we live in. We live in a vulnerable world, and one of many ways we deal with this is to numb vulnerability. And I think there's evidence, it's not the only reason this evidence exists, but I think it's a huge cause. We are the most in-debt, obese, addicted, medicated adult cohort in U.S. history. The problem is, and as I learned from this research, that you cannot selectively numb emotion. You can't say, here's the bad stuff, here's the vulnerability, here's the grief, here's the shame, here's fear, here's disappointment. I don't want to feel these. I'm going to have a couple of beers and a banana nut muffin. I don't want to feel these. You can't numb those hard feelings without numbing the effects and our emotions. You cannot selectively numb. So when we numb those, we numb joy. We numb gratitude. We numb happiness. And when we're miserable and we're looking for purpose and meaning and we feel vulnerable, so when we have a couple beers and a banana nut muffin and it becomes a dangerous lifestyle. The more afraid we are, the more vulnerable we are, the more afraid we are. How do we numb? Is it alcohol? Is it eating out? Is it sports? Is it the internet? Is it spending money? Maybe money we don't have, such as using a credit card. How do we numb? As Dr. Brown noted, we cannot selectively numb. We cannot numb our fears. We cannot numb our feelings of guilt. We cannot numb our anger and hurt. We cannot numb jealousy and envy without impacting the positive aspects of our lives. It's a dangerous cycle, and we cannot allow this to happen. We need to face all of our emotions head on and not numb them, but transform them into different behaviors. Different emotions. We need to change fear into confidence, jealousy into contentment, anger into peace, guilt into an honest assessment of ourselves. That is emotional maturity. And we do this through working with God. We team up with God and make use of His Spirit in our lives. And we have to acknowledge that at times, when we make decisions, we need to make them emotionally mature decisions as we go forward. And I'm not saying that all of a sudden we all live an austere life, unless that's what the situation dictates. But we make our decisions with emotional maturity. Financial decisions are made with facts, and decisions are made with a clear understanding of what one can and cannot do in light of the prudent goals we set. If it doesn't matter if we have the available funds or don't have them. It's our emotional outlook, it's our emotional maturity, our temperance that defines financial stability. It is the key that will not only allow us to put our financial house in order, but I believe it's a key to put our life in order. We need to recognize our attitude to money and possessions is a matter of the heart. It states in Matthew 6, verse 21, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. In explaining the symbol of the heart, Strong's exhaustive concordant defines the heart in this verse as thought or feelings. Feelings, emotions. By inference, we can render this verse, where your treasure is, there your emotions will be also. So where is our treasure? Where are our emotions?